Hey there, good listeners. For a limited time, when you make a gift to PRI's The World, your donation will be matched. That means double the support for the show and the work we do here day after day. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks. Beyond Russian Interference, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When it comes to election meddling and hacking, the spotlight is almost always on Russia these days. Democrat Adam Schiff says things will be different when he takes over as chair of the House Intelligence Committee in January. He wants to focus on threats to democracy worldwide.
The American people need to be aware of what's going on all over the world. It's a threat to the very idea of a liberal democracy, and this will be one of our focuses on the committee.
Also today, the Republic of Georgia has just elected a new president. The opposition is challenging the vote, but that's not what's getting the most international attention.
It's ironic to see many headlines in the Western media saying, oh, the first woman president elected.
All that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is great to have you along with us this Friday. Anticipation is growing. Special Counsel Robert Mueller may be close to delivering his report on Russian attempts to interfere with the 2016 presidential election and possible links to the Trump campaign.
I wouldn't be surprised if he attempted to conclude a report by the end of the year.
That's Representative Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. I spoke with him via Skype earlier today. We'll get to the timing of the Mueller report in a couple of minutes. First, though, I asked Schiff for his reaction to the plea deal by Donald Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. Cohen admitted this week that he misled the House Intelligence Committee about Trump's business ties to Russia during the election campaign.
Well, I have to say it's not a complete surprise. There have been a number of witnesses that we've had profound concerns over whether they've been truthful with us. But it is astonishing that the substance, at least this part of his testimony, involves this deal that the president was denying that he was pursuing at that point, where Russians were hacking our institutions, where the Russians were making overtures to the Trump campaign at Trump Tower. That this secret negotiation was going on is quite breathtaking.
The president tweeted overnight that there was nothing wrong with running a business while running for president and that he made no secret about it. Is his defense essentially, so what?
Well, of course, he did make a secret about it. He did hide it from the American people. He flatly said that he was doing no business with Russia, had no interest in dealings with Russia. All of that was untrue. And he knew it was untrue. And so what he's saying now is also untrue, because he didn't tell the country about it. It is astonishing to me that a candidate for president would be, while a hostile foreign power is providing assistance to his campaign by attacking his opponent, would conceal from the American people that he was seeking a lucrative business deal, that his team was reaching out to the Kremlin for help with the deal. All of this was going on outside of the public view. All of this was being concealed from the American people who were going to the polls to figure out who would represent the interests of the country.
A lot of Trump's base will agree. So what? It's the word of a New York lawyer against the president we voted for.
Well, I mean, there's certainly some people, as the president has bragged, that would stick with him even if he shot someone in the middle of the street. But increasingly, I think Americans are turning away from this president because they recognize his lack of character. They recognize the essential immorality of this president, a certain corruption of character.
So come January, you will be chair of the House Intelligence Committee. What is going to be your first priority?
Well, I think one of the first hearings that I want to have of our committee takes a look at what is going on globally. And that is, we see a real rise of authoritarianism around the world. We're hyper-conscious of what Russia did to interfere in our democracy 2 years ago. But the fact is that Russia has been interfering in many other parts of the world. And even separate apart from the malevolent Russian actions, there is a global trend towards autocracy. And in a normal world, the United States would be leading the pushback. It would be the champion of democracy and human rights. That is not happening under this president. And the American people need to be aware of what's going on all over the world. It's a threat to the very idea of a liberal democracy, and this will be one of our focuses on the committee.
How tense will things become in January? Like, what is your working relationship like with the White House? Because the president mistyped your name in a tweet earlier this month to make it sound like an obscenity.
I don't think there was any mistyping involved in that. I think it was quite deliberate.
I'm trying to be charitable here. Yeah.
You are being very charitable. Well, look, I think we can expect, sadly, the same treatment that Bob Mueller is getting, which is we can expect relentless attacks. We can expect a lot of rope-a-dope and stalling, and at the same time bemoaning how long the investigation is taking while they're dragging it out. So this is our expectation. I would, you know, would love to be pleasantly surprised, but I think we're likely to face nothing but obstruction.
Congressman, let me come to one more hypothetical. Come January, Trump himself said this week that a pardon for Paul Manafort is not off the table. That was made clear after it became known that Manafort, Trump's former campaign chair, had lied to special counsel Robert Mueller despite his plea deal. I mean, what is your take on that, and how would you respond to a pardon?
Well, I would say that obstruction of justice is not off the table. That would unquestionably be part of the body of evidence that the president is obstructing justice. The dangling of the pardon alone may be an act of obstruction of justice. And combined with other acts the president has taken, the firing of Comey, the attacks on Bob Mueller, the choice of Matt Whitaker, it paints a pretty vivid portrait of obstruction of justice. But there'd be few acts quite as dramatic, save the firing of Comey, as the pardon of a witness potentially against him.
Has Mueller given you a date or a range of dates for that report?
No, he hasn't. And I don't expect that he will. I think he has properly kept his cards very close to the vest. I wouldn't be surprised if he attempted to conclude a report by the end of the year. But a lot of that timing may depend on whether he determines that it's necessary to subpoena the president and compel him to answer questions about that issue of obstruction of justice, because intent is such a key component of an obstruction of justice case. I think he needs to subpoena the president, but he may decide conservatively not to, or he may decide strategically that it would take too long to litigate it in court and that time is operating against him, not with him. But that may impact more than any other single factor, the timing of any report.
Congressman Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been another, let's say, eventful week in Trump news. And for many of us, it all feels a little like deja vu.
My friends, let me make one thing clear. This is a nation of laws. And as Abraham Lincoln has said, no one is above the law, no one is below the law, and we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law and order.
That's President Richard Nixon pushing his law and order agenda. But Nixon himself then faced an FBI investigation in 1972 after a break-in at the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in Washington at the Watergate Hotel. Evidence emerged of Nixon's involvement in efforts to undermine his political opponents. But his supporters stuck with him.
I think the people should support the president, and I think it's really rotten the way they've been talking about him.
I still feel that it was his aides that more or less must stand to blame for it.
Meanwhile, members of Nixon's administration tried to dismiss the whole thing as fake news, but they called it something else.
I don't respect the type of journalism, the shabby journalism that is being practiced by the Washington Post. And I use the term shoddy journalism, shabby journalism, and I've used the term character assassination.
You know the end of the story. Nixon resigned under threat of impeachment. All these voices we've just heard are from a Showtime documentary called Enemies, the President, Justice, and the FBI. It's based on a book by Tim Weiner, who's joining me now from New York. I mean, the gist of the four-part series is really the tension between the White House and the FBI through successive administrations. When it comes to Nixon, it really kind of reframes the Watergate story. It's not one of tension between Nixon and his opponents, but Nixon and the FBI, right?
Watergate was the first time that Americans realized that the president himself could be a threat to American national security. And when that happens, there's only one force that can really investigate the president, and that's the FBI.
I mean, as I watch some of this footage in the Nixon episode, it feels kind of eerie, especially with Michael Cohen's guilty plea yesterday. It's like we're watching a repeat of Nixon with no sense of course of where it's all going to end up. Was that kind of the point of your series?
it was exactly the point. The parallels between what happened in Watergate and what is happening right now are extraordinary. The central difference is that Richard Nixon was a political genius and Donald Trump is not.
The Nixon tapes play a big part in the whole Watergate story. And of course, they play a big part in your documentary. My mind still boggles why everything was recorded. But listening to them is fascinating. There is one moment when Nixon is telling his FBI director how to deal with leaks. All right. The audio quality is bad, but Richard Nixon there is referring to the Nazi strategy in World War II, going into towns and villages across Europe, lining up the whole population in the town and telling them unless they give up the enemy, everyone's going to get shot. It's probably hyperbole, but I mean, it's a reminder of the power that resides in the Oval Office, especially the current one.
After J. Edgar Hoover died, Nixon installed a political loyalist, a stooge, really, named Pat Gray to run the FBI in the hope that he could control the FBI. Not unlike Donald Trump putting Matthew Whitaker in as acting attorney general in the hope that he can control or at least monitor Robert Mueller's investigation, which, by the way, is being conducted by agents of the FBI. The confrontation we have here is the president is not a king. He is not above the law. He takes an oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution and the rule of law. When he violates it, it is the FBI that has to confront him. Only the FBI has the power to march up to the White House, seize documents, and that day is probably not too far away.
How are we supposed to reconcile this admirable independence of the FBI from the executive office with his tendency to also have agents who go rogue, kind of all the way to the top of the organization?
There have been in history two FBIs, really. The 20th century FBI was largely J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. He ran it for 48 years. The 21st century FBI is much more Robert Mueller's FBI. Yes, they screw up. Yes, the power of the FBI is awesome and they have abused it. But you have the remarkable situation now where Mueller, FBI director, former, and Jim Comey, FBI director, former, are now aligned against the President of the United States. Comey is Mueller's star witness on the matter of obstruction of justice.
When you look around the world, Tim, is the U.S. different when it comes to this tension between the nation's top law enforcement body and the executive, like MI5 and 10 Downing Street in the U.K.? Or, I mean, I doubt it's the case with the FSB and the Kremlin because Putin is kind of the FSB. But do you see like a formula where there's less tension between intelligence and the executive? Is there probably less democracy?
I don't want to make a case for American exceptionalism, but we have a president who, from his first day in office, brutally attacked the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Justice, railing against them, calling them the deep state. We don't have a deep state in this country. We happen to have a shallow government right now.
What should we expect from the rest of the series? There are three more episodes focusing on Reagan, Clinton, and the last one on Trump.
The Trump episode is 2 hours. It airs December 9th, and I think you will see laid out in very graphic terms the challenge that we as a nation now face with a president with enormous power who is in the crosshairs of a criminal investigation and who feels the hot breath of Robert Mueller's bloodhounds closing in.
Journalist Tim Weiner, producer of the four-part series Enemies, the President, Justice, and the FBI on Showtime. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code WORLD into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel caramel apple tartlets. Plus, get four more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type WORLD into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Republic of Georgia has a new president. Salome Zurabishvili was elected this week. She's a former diplomat born to Georgian emigres in Paris, and now she's the country's first woman president. At least that's the news that's been dominating Western headlines. But there is more to the story. Here's what Natalia Antalava had to say. She's the founder of Coda Story in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi.
It's been a sad week for Georgian democracy, and it's funny knowing that context and knowing the background. It's ironic to see many headlines in the Western media saying, oh, the first woman president elected.
Part of that context is that the opposition has now rejected the vote, calling for protests and a new election. I asked Natalia how a new election would be possible in Georgia's parliamentary democracy and what called for it in the first place.
Georgia is a parliamentary democracy, a very fragile parliamentary democracy. And the way the election worked here this time was definitely sort of not quite up to the standards, which is a very sad step back for Georgia because it is in the post-Soviet region in the whole for the last 15 years. Since 2003 revolution, it's really been held up as the hope for democracy and freedom. But this election, Georgia definitely rolled way back.
So what does the opposition actually say happened during the campaign and the election of Salome Zurabishvili?
Well, I think what's important here, it's not just what the opposition says, it's what all of us saw. And it was quite a sight to watch the campaign. On one hand, we have this woman with a very tiny political footprint in Georgia, pretty much an unknown candidate. But she was picked by the oligarch, backed by the ruling party. She ran officially as an independent. And then we saw the government pour millions and millions and millions into her election campaign. I know personally stories of some serious voter intimidation, people being told that they will lose their jobs if they didn't vote for her.
You say Georgians saw this negative, dirty campaign as it was happening. So they still elected her with 60%. I mean, those are official numbers.
They are official numbers. We will not know how much of the vote buying affected these numbers, but probably the result is clear enough that she would have won. She did have, it was a very unequal campaign because the opposition didn't have anywhere near the resources that she had. Ultimately, you know, I think what's really interesting about this election is the fact that it's really well in tune with everything else that's going on in the world. The playbook, sort of the democratic playbook, which Georgia has been trying so hard to hold up, and the rules that they were trying so hard to play by, that playbook was just thrown out, and the government did everything it could, did not shy away from any method they could think of to push the candidate forward. And they employed, even though her rhetoric, her official rhetoric is very pro-Western and pro-European, she was a candidate that Moscow was very excited about.
Why does Moscow like Zurabishvili?
I think Moscow likes Salome Zurabishvili because she is ultimately not a candidate of her own, not a politician of her own mind. And that may sound like it's a bit of an unfair thing to say, but the only reason that she has the position that she has is because she's been put there by the Georgian, by the oligarch who is a former prime minister, Bedina Ivanishvili, the man with the ties to Kremlin. He's not an elected politician anymore, but he is the man who pulls all the strings. He is the godfather, and Moscow is very comfortable with this kind of setup of the mix of the appearance of a political structure, but also a little bit of an informal rule that gives Russia more leverages, more ways to put pressure than it had before. Look, for the shopping window, it's very nice. I mean, she's a very eloquent, in some ways, French diplomat. She looks the part. She looks quite presidential. But at the same time, you know, if you think about the tactics her campaign has used to get her where she is. So she says she's pro-Western and her relationships with the EU institutions are clearly, you know, that's where she comes from. But at the same time, she has said things like Sergei Lavrov is her ideal diplomat. and that Georgia should not dream of NATO membership because it's a misleading dream. So all these things that she says to the electorate at home that make Moscow very happy, which she doesn't say in her interviews in French and English.
So the headline, First Woman President for Georgia, sounds kind of tainted. How hard will Georgia have to work to clean up its elections right now?
It's almost, you can very clearly see how stuck the opposition feels. And I think the biggest danger that faces Georgia right now is the loss of faith in the electoral process. And I think it's more complicated than just the domestic politics. Georgia is the only country where a president conceded defeat in a democratic election and stepped down. There are not many other precedents in the former Soviet Union. But the democracy here has been so fragile, and it's so important for the democracy to work, for the people to continue gaining trust in it.
Natalia Antalava with CODA Story, speaking with us from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. Thanks for being here, Natalia.
Thank you very much.
And now this. Why Madonna? Not that you ever need an excuse to play Madonna, some of her catalog anyway. But today, there's an actual reason. Strike. Let me back up 24 hours. Yesterday, UNESCO, the UN's cultural and scientific agency, released its annual list of so-called intangible cultural heritage. For example, reggae, as we told you, made the list. But there was nothing from the U.S. on the list because we're not part of the Cultural Heritage Convention. But I asked you yesterday, if the U.S. were eligible, what intangible cultural thing would you want to see on the list? This is where Madonna comes in. Jay Lassiter from New Jersey, bless his heart, said voguing. The dance actually comes from drag balls in Harlem in the 1970s and 80s and was pushed into the pop mainstream by the Material Girl. We got some other great responses. Pete Sherman in Salt Lake City said Cajun and Creole music. Right on, Pete. I totally agree. Buckwheat Zydeco there with his track T-Na-Na. And one more nomination from John Gazarek in Washington. He said the seventh inning stretch, you know, that point in a baseball game where fans stand up and work out the kinks. Here in Boston, we stretch twice, once in the seventh inning and once in the eighth, to the tune of Sweet Caroline. And let me go out on a limb here and just say, Neil Diamond, you're a treasure, but you're too tangible for the UNESCO list. Sweet Caroline, good times never seem so good. No good, no good. I've been to believe that never one but look at the night. Who won the series again? Anyway, thanks everyone for your responses. To see more of them, check out our Instagram story at PRI The World. In case you haven't heard, PRI's The World is participating in Newsmatch. It's a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. We have the opportunity to receive $25,000 in matching funds. It would support the journalism you hear every day on this show. Please make a contribution today for the global perspectives, international reporting, and diverse voices you hear on The World. Visit theworld.org/match, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Marco Werman. A new version of Disney's Moana is out today, and it's dubbed in Hawaiian. O'ahu'o Moana
no motunui. I think it's a better movie in Hawaiian. I think the themes are much more resonant. I think the songs make much more sense.
Moana and the revival of the Hawaiian language. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There's justice today for Berta Cáceres, some justice anyway. Cáceres was an environmental activist in Honduras. She'd been fighting to stop construction of a hydroelectric dam that would have encroached on the land and rivers of the Lenca people. They're the largest indigenous group in the country. In September 2016, Cáceres was murdered. Journalist Nina Lacani has been following the case in the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa.
The trial that concluded yesterday was a trial against eight of the men accused of Berta's murder. So we're talking about the sicarios and we're talking about the intermediaries. But what the verdict yesterday was very clear about, we found seven of the men guilty. One man was found not guilty, that the crime was paid for by the dam company DESA. And so what we learned yesterday and what her family have always said was that the people on trial yesterday were the middlemen, you know, the hitmen. They weren't the masterminds behind the crime. They weren't the ones who ordered the crime, who paid for the crime and who benefited from it.
So will there be any further prosecution of anybody from the company or from the government?
David Castillo, who has yet to face trial, he's the company president and a minority shareholder. He's also a former US-trained military intelligence officer, and he's been accused of masterminding the crime. So he should face trial either next year or by 2020 at the latest. We also heard in the trial that the Elvin Rapalo, who is the young man who shot Berta at her house in March 2016, he later confessed to an acquaintance who became a state's protected witness that he had killed Berta, but that he felt sure that, you know, he would never face justice because the order had come from above. Who was he talking about? You know, there were many clues, many lines of investigation which could lead to politicians, to other people in the armed forces, to the economic elites in this country, which have not yet been investigated.
I mean, it all seems to speak volumes of Berta Cáceres' ability to organize. How big a campaign was this of hers, this opposition to Honduras's Aguazarca Dam?
She saw it as an emblematic case. These energy projects, renewable energy projects, including dams, solar power, wind power, were being sanctioned across the country without consultation, you know, under the guise of development. But actually, most of this energy was going to be, you know, diverted to power mines and other projects, not just in Honduras, but in the whole Central America. And she was often, you know, criticized and condemned as being anti-development, anti-progress. But, you know, really, it's important to say that she was supporting the community. She didn't enforce this opposition on them. They came to her and to Copin to help them resist the dam because they depend on the river for food, for water, for their livestock, to bathe in. You know, without the river, the community cannot exist. They would have had to leave the Rio Blanco community near the river and may have been forced to migrate either to one of the overcrowded cities here or even to the U.S.
Nina, did the dam get built? And are you hearing anything from the Lenca people about this verdict?
Yesterday outside the courtroom, lots of members of the community and Copin were there. You know, it was a really strange mix of emotions. People were obviously happy or, you know, satisfied to some extent, relieved, I think, that some justice had been served. But it was so mixed in with anger and frustration and deep, deep sadness at the loss of Berta, you know, who was a great leader, not just for her Lenca people, but for the Honduran people more widely. The dam hasn't been built. Construction was suspended after she was murdered. One of the key points that her lawyers made yesterday was that the license must now be revoked so that this threat that this dam poses on the local community, on the Lenca people and her organization, Copin, is once and for all finished with.
Reporter Nina Lacani speaking with us from Tegucigalpa about the trial of the men convicted for the murder of Berta Cáceres. Thanks very much, Nina.
Thanks.
What happens in Mexico tomorrow could have an impact on the lives of many Hondurans. That's when Mexico's new president will take office. Andrés Manuel López Obrador was actually elected back in July, but Mexico has a long transition period. Now that AMLO, as he's known, is finally taking office, it looks like there's no time for a honeymoon. He's facing an immediate humanitarian and political crisis on the U.S. border, with thousands of Central American migrants, including many Hondurans, stuck in Tijuana. Here's Emily Green in Mexico City.
As a candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador promised to support migrants. He also presented himself as someone who would stand up to President Trump. and he frequently criticized the American leader.
Ya ven que Trump es muy presumido.
Like in this debate in April, when López Obrador called Trump boastful. On another occasion, López Obrador said he would put Trump in his place. The relationship of these two fiery leaders is being tested even sooner than expected because of the migrant caravans. And that's provided a dose of reality, says Esteban Iades, a journalist and political analyst in Mexico.
The migrant caravan is probably the starting point of the next Mexico-U.S. relation. So definitely López Obrador and his team are trying to balance different things in order to keep both Donald Trump and Mexicans happy without creating some sort of international crisis.
President Trump isn't coming to Saturday's inauguration, but his daughter Ivanka is. And on Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will meet with his Mexican counterpart to discuss border security. They have very different ideas about what that looks like. López Obrador wants the U.S. to commit more economic aid to Central American countries. Trump wants Mexico to fortify its southern border. But the most pressing problem for both countries is the more than 6,000 migrants camped out in Tijuana, says Andrew Seeley, president of the Migration Policy Institute.
I think we really do have a loose cannon here, and it's creating some really unpredictable situations for both Mexican and U.S. authorities.
Also dangerous ones, like on Sunday, when a peaceful march became chaotic after some migrants tried to cross into the U.S. illegally. And U.S. Border Patrol agents fired tear gas into Mexico. President Trump defended the border agents. He has also demanded that migrants who apply for asylum in the U.S. remain in Mexico while their cases are decided. It would basically put Mexico on the front lines of enforcing U.S. immigration policy. Andrew Seeley says the shocking thing, López Obrador appears to be strongly considering the idea.
There was bewilderment on why an incoming administration was agreeing to something that seemed to be wholly in the benefit of the United States.
Seeley says one reason López Obrador might consider such a deal would be if the U.S. agrees to process asylum claims quicker. U.S. Customs and Border Protection only accepts around 40 to 80 asylum seekers a day at the Tijuana-San Diego border crossing. There are close to 6,000 people on a wait list, around half from the caravans. And for now, they're stuck in Tijuana. Many are staying here at this sports complex turned shelter, and they are looking to López Obrador. José Luis Martínez is from Honduras. He says he hopes López Obrador helps Mexicans and also migrants like him who want to stay in Mexico and work. López Obrador has said he will give work visas to Central American migrants, although letting them all stay in Tijuana could create a major backlash. Big picture, the migrant caravans are not as big an issue in Mexico as they are in the U.S. Most Mexicans are focused on other issues, like violence and jobs. But sentiment is turning against the migrants. A recent poll in a major Mexican newspaper suggests that 49% of Mexicans believe caravans shouldn't be allowed to cross the country, meaning López Obrador will be governing a country that is starting to look more like the U.S., For the World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
Fred Ramos helped us with that story. This next item is also about a murder investigation. Last March, two UN researchers were looking into possible human rights violations in the Democratic Republic of Congo when they were killed in an ambush. American Michael Sharp and Zaida Catalan from Sweden were trying to collect information on atrocities, things like the mass killing of more than 5,000 people, in a region where local militias were fighting with the military. The Congolese government and a UN investigation determined that the two died in a random attack. But now there are suggestions that the Congolese military may have been involved and that the UN buried the evidence. Reporter Colm Lynch has been following the story for Foreign Policy magazine. I asked him what we know about what happened to Sharp and Catalan.
the night before they died. They were seeking sort of assurances that they would be safe if they went to these areas to talk to local civilians and militias about awful things that were happening there. They were led to believe in that conversation that everything would be fine. And the next morning they headed off. They hired a Congolese translator and they hired three motorcycle drivers and they drove towards a town called Bukande. They didn't make it to Bukande. They were stopped by a group of armed men who opened fire. We don't know what happened immediately after, but a very grisly video of the execution was filmed by one of the assailants. And in that, we see Michael and Zeta being marched out into a field, moved towards the brush, ordered to sit down, and then executed.
So after Zeta and Michael were killed, the UN and the FBI sent officials to piece together evidence about what had happened. What did the UN report released some months later in August say?
In headquarters, after the murder of UN officials, you do what's called a board of inquiry. They travel to Congo and they produce this report in August, which reached a similar conclusion to the Congolese government that Michael and Zeta had stumbled blindly into an ambush by a local militia group. But they made it pretty clear that they didn't think there was sufficient evidence that maybe the government was involved. The family, though, was very dissatisfied with the report and they were angry because the Board of Inquiry focused almost exclusively on security protocols and was critical of Michael and Zeta's actions and sort of described them as having made a mistake.
Right. But it did sound like some journalists and some of the UN investigators were not fully convinced that this was a random ambush. What was it that seemed off?
So there were a couple of things going on. At the same time, the Board of Inquiry is doing their report. The UN police and some journalists, they were doing their own investigations. They discovered, for instance, that in the meeting they had with the militia the night before the killing, the meeting had been recorded secretly by Zeta. And when they did a transcript, they realized that there were two individuals there who were translating. And the militia leaders were basically saying, no, it's not safe to go there. But they were translating it into French and saying, oh, you're going to be perfectly fine there. Yeah. It turned out later that these individuals who were mistranslating the conversation had deep contacts with the Congolese intelligence and security agencies. What's also extraordinary is that the killers decided to record the execution. There were two individuals who were behind the camera giving the orders, and they occasionally spoke Lingala, which is customarily identified with the military. And so when some local language experts looked at that, they said, this just doesn't seem right. And UN police and some journalists began to sort of develop a theory that maybe this was a setup.
Why did the UN downplay evidence of the role of the Congolese government?
Well, there's another surreptitiously recorded conversation between the Sharp family, also the Moresby family, Zeta Katlan's family. When they spoke with the Board of Inquiry, they recorded those conversations and they shared those conversations with us. The Board of Inquiry makes it perfectly clear to them that they do not see the value of including anything that would implicate the government in the killing. And the reason they say is that if they did that, it would undermine any prospects of cooperation in the future. Another element is that the UN has one of its largest peacekeeping missions in the world there. And there's some sensitivity that if you were accusing the government of murdering one of your own, that that might jeopardize the relationship. So there were lots of large diplomatic concerns in play. And the family feels that this led to a certain kind of bias in the Board of Inquiry assessment of what had happened.
There is going to be a trial in the DRC. Hard to imagine it's going to be a very fair trial. I know you spent a lot of time speaking with the family of Michael Sharp. How have they been trying to reconcile, you know, the passion of their son's desire to make the world a better place, but also the possibility that in this particular episode, he and Zeta Katlan might have been, as the investigators said, reckless?
I don't think that the family believed that they were reckless. And I think there is a lot of support from the broader community of sanctions experts. And, you know, I was having a conversation with Michael Sharp's father, John Sharp, and I was asking him, you know, what would you consider to be real accountability and justice? And he was sort of conflicted about it because, you know, they come from a family of Mennonite missionaries and their views of justice are not Old Testament. He sees this very much as, what would justice be in this? Would it be violence for violence? You know, do they find a couple of people? Do they execute them or put them in jail for life? Is that the outcome that we want. And he was saying that he would like to see some more restorative form of justice and also something that honors his son's experience and sacrifice. He had dedicated his life trying to pursue just a better course of life for the Congolese and trying to sort of resolve conflicts in the area. And so Michael Sharp's father had a very complicated take on this whole question of how do you find justice?
Foreign policy diplomatic reporter Colm Lynch speaking with us from New York. Thanks very much for telling us this story, Colm.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Remy the Rat and his friends in Ratatouille got dubbed into French for the Francophone market. Makes sense on screen. The film is set in Paris. Characters in Disney's 1992 feature, Aladdin, got dubbed into Arabic.
Ah, ahlan wa sahlan. Assalamu alaikum, muhtaram.
Now the 2016 Disney film Moana is getting dubbed into Hawaiian. This is kind of different, though. The movie takes place on a fictional Hawaiian island, but today there are very few native speakers of Hawaiian left in Hawaii, even though it was the only language spoken in the islands until Westerners began arriving in the 18th century. And that's part of the reason that Chris Lee wanted the chance to dub Moana into Olelo Hawaii. Lee is a founder of the Academy for Creative Media in Honolulu. Chris, good to meet you. Olelo Hawaii. Now, tell us what that means.
It means the language of Hawaii or the Hawaiian language in English.
Gotcha. So tell us what we just heard in that clip from Moana in Hawaiian. And for people who know the movie, what part of the film is this?
So this is the scene where our star, Alii Carvalho, the Moana of the title, and she plays the part both in the original English language version and here in Hawaiian, meets Maui for the first time and has come to take Maui back to right the world, essentially. And she's been rehearsing this speech over and over again. And then, of course, everything goes a little bit awry when she actually meets him.
Aulie plays Moana. What about the other character voices in the film, in the dubbed version? Are they still the same original?
We have one other original player, Nicole Scherzinger, who's probably most famous for being a member of the Pussycat Dolls, and she's also from Hawaii. She's from Waianae here on Oahu. But everybody else was cast locally. I think we cast about 30 local performers out of maybe about 140 that auditioned for us, all of whom were fluent in the Hawaiian language.
What about translating a Disney movie into Hawaiian? How challenging was that?
Well, it's a challenge because there are many ways to do it. But we had an incredibly talented translation team led by a gentleman named Puakea Nogelmeyer. And he and his team had to translate about 10,000 words from the script and from the songs and the dialogue. And they had to translate them both for meaning, so that the meaning was appropriate, and also, quite frankly, for lip flap, because we couldn't reanimate any of the movie. So we had to pick words that would fit as best possible into the mouths that were already animated.
Do you have a good example of that?
There's a song that's called You're Welcome in English, and it's sung in the movie by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And in this case, our performer is Kaipo Baker, who's actually a student at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and he plays Maui in our film. And there's no actual Hawaiian word for you're welcome. So the term that they came up with is I did it for you, which is no-iel, which also fits pretty well into the mouth of saying you're welcome.
Gotcha.
In English.
That's fascinating. So I want to know why you at the Academy for Creative Media wanted this gig. I mean, how did you even get the gig in the first place?
Well, actually, you know, I started the Academy at one camp, the Manoa campus, back in 2002, 2003. And one of our earliest students wrote to me and he said he had heard that there were versions of the film being done in Tahitian and in Maori, which was the case. They had actually been done in both those languages. And he said, do you think we could do one in the Hawaiian language? And I thought, that's a fantastic idea. So I actually went over and met with the Disney folks in Burbank and kind of a little bit of cajoling because it's a lot of work. And, you know, when they went to Tahiti, Tahiti didn't even have even the basic equipment to do this. But the University of Hawaii has actually invested into different areas of creative media. So we had an absolute first-class recording studio to work with.
There you go. Disney films, they're still intended for kids, right? I'm just wondering what, you know, children in Hawaii are going to make of this.
Well, that's the main reason we did this, because it's a fantastic tool to encourage students to learn the language. Because unfortunately, the Hawaiian language was essentially literally outlawed by the missionaries and was almost a dead language by the 1970s. And then there was a confluence of a revival of music, of hula, and the language through these immersion schools. And actually, many of our performers came out of these immersion schools.
And how far are you going to take this? Because my producer, Tracy, who's from Hawaii, she was telling me that school kids from 4th grade to 12th grade had to learn about the culture, the history, how to speak Hawaiian. Do you see this movie being part of that curriculum?
So later today, we are actually having our DVD release party, and we'll begin the distribution, and we will have the Department of Education there. We'll have the immersion schools. We'll have the Kamehameha schools, which are the schools that you have to have Hawaiian blood to attend. The Catholic schools, the independent schools, and we'll just keep going until we've, you know, hit every school in the islands. You know, there's never been a Hollywood film of this scope and size and, of its box office status to be translated into Hawaiian. This is actually the 46th language that Moana has been translated into, and
no
it's
kidding.
The most languages of any Disney movie.
So what took so
we're
long?
Really, it's a good question, but it is a lot of work. And, you know, it did take quite a team. It took us about a year and a half altogether to get this done. Because you have to re-record everything. And we actually worked with the Disney team that is responsible and just spends all their time going around the world translating everything out of Disney or ABC into various languages. And they were, they came out for the first week and then they left and then they said they were very impressed. We had all the toys and we had great performers and they couldn't be more pleased with the outcome.
So let me ask you something that is not a language question, because Disney often will take a story like Pocahontas, for example, which kind of does a disservice, many say, to the story of the Jamestown colony. Did Disney get it right with Moana?
I certainly think so, but I will say this with no disrespect to the original team. Two of the writers actually are from Hawaii, Aaron and Jordan Kandel. They actually went to my high school, Iolani, and they're prominent Hollywood screenwriters, so they've chosen to live in Hawaii now. Mm. And I think it's a better movie in Hawaiian. I think the themes are much more resonant. I think the songs make much more sense. So I couldn't be prouder and happier to affect with this great team and bring this into reality. And one of the people that is on the Oceanic Story Trust that worked on it, he feels that anybody who felt like there was any sort of cultural reappropriation, this is kind of a reappropriation of their cultural appropriation. So hopefully everybody can enjoy the film. I can't wait for more and more people to see it.
Chris Lee is the founder of the Academy for Creative Media in Honolulu. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you, Marco.
That's Tracy Keolalani with the opening song for the newly dubbed into Hawaiian version of Moana. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. The world's theme was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman, wishing you all a great weekend. See you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.